Roundtable Osteuropa. Ein Podcast des Zentrums für Osteuropa und internationale Studien.
Hello everybody and welcome to a new edition of our Zeus podcast series Roundtable Eastern Europe. In this podcast, we will discuss how market integration in Europe shapes the room for development in Europe's eastern and southern peripheral economies, and what lessons can be learned for integration projects in other parts of the world. One of the key claims used to legitimate market integration was that the free movement of goods, capital, services, and labor will automatically produce benefits for all participating countries without much supranational intervention. This position is increasingly being challenged in Europe. Strong political forces in both the southern and eastern peripheries claim the European project has stifled, rather than improved, their ability to grow, as indicated by persisting economic disparities within the European Union. And even in the scholarly literature, the dominating view is that market integration distributes gains and losses among participating countries unevenly, and it has the uniform effect of decreasing the room for development in peripheral economies. Uneven development in highly integrated and interdependent economies is a source of considerable risk and has been amply demonstrated by the ongoing public health crisis and is likely to become even more apparent with the economic fallout that is sure to follow. And while we see EU attempts to level the playing field through its transnational industrial policy, the standard response, get the incentives right, be disciplined and let the market do the work, is looking ever less convincing. So the key question is whether there is another way for transnational integration regimes to help promote development in the peripheries. I'm happy to be able to discuss this question with two distinguished colleagues with whom I've been collaborating on a recently published special issue for the Review of International Political Economy that deals with this question. Vera Sepanovic joins us from Budapest. She is a lecturer in international relations and European studies at Leiden University. Her research focuses on the transnational dimension of development in East Central Europe and the EU's southern members. Welcome, Vera.
Hello, Julia.
My second guest is Laszlo Proust, who joins us from New York City. Laszlo is professor of sociology at Central European University in Budapest and is currently visiting professor at Columbia University. His more recent studies deal with the politics of market integration. And my name is Julia Langbein. I'm senior researcher at Zeus, where I lead the research cluster Political Economy and Integration. And I think it's necessary to first clarify the general problems of market integration among diverse economies. Laszlo, could you please briefly provide an overview of the broader differences among integration strategies applied by the EU and the problems these integration strategies seek to address?
Yes, I would start with the Second World War dominating regime in Europe and also in the global markets. That was what was called the Bretton Woods regime, or by John Ruggie was called embedded liberalism. It basically combined a somewhat freer movement of goods with national level control over the movement of factors of production. So it basically left to domestic states and domestic democracies to control the developmental consequences of markets and market economies in general. Now, that is what dramatically changed after the 1980s and early 90s in Europe, after the Single European Act. And that is a new regime that we, with Julia, in a paper, we called disembedded liberalism, because that gave primacy to the extension of markets by way of pooling sovereignty, taking away from member states the possibility of regulating markets, preventing the freer flow of goods and factors of production. And it centralized this, and as a dominating strategy, left member states only the management of the developmental consequences of these freer markets. It had also experimented and is now experimenting with newer versions of market correcting policies, but it's important to stress that they are marginal. So all these policies like the structural funds or the Juncker's plan did not spend more than 1% of the European GDP on this kind of market correcting policies. So the point is that in this new regime, integration regime, market integration is primarily a supranational function, and the national states and the member states have to manage the developmental consequences. And the EU is also unique because it's been the furthest in this kind of integration in the world, so it has lots of lessons for other countries. Now, the second part of this question, this general question, what are the problems that these integration regimes have to solve? What are the key management problems? And one is the differences in the capacities of the member states to implement these rules, to play by these rules. It refers primarily to the administrative and legal capacity of the states to implement these rules. And the problem is that if there are too large differences, then the market can disintegrate. Basically, countries will not play by these rules. The other problem is that countries have very different capacities to gain from these rules or to benefit from these rules. That has to do partly with pre-existing endowments, differences in competitiveness. But it has also very much to do both with the capacities of states and the capacities of economic players. They might differ dramatically. The most important problems, and that we discuss also in this special issue, is that states in these integration regimes can dramatically differ in the autonomy and capacity to implement broad-based developmental problems that can increase the range of beneficiaries of market integration. And that's the biggest problem that states have to address, and also integration regimes have to address.
Yeah, well, maybe that's now a good time to actually look at the question how these different integration strategies applied by the EU shape domestic capacities for promoting development in the three peripheries. So, I mean, we've looked in the special issue, we looked at three peripheries, the neighboring states outside the EU, the southern lesser developed member states, and the eastern lesser developed member states. And I think I will simply maybe start with describing a little bit more in depth how the EU shapes domestic capacities for promoting development in the neighboring states outside the EU that don't have a membership perspective. And these group of countries include countries like Armenia, Belarus, or Ukraine. And the integration strategy that was applied by the EU actually was applied since the 1990s. But then there are also other countries belonging to this group, like Turkey, before the start of accession negotiations. And interestingly, this strategy is similar to the pre-1986 strategy of the EU that Laszlo described a bit earlier. And importantly, the strategy is based first on the notion that economic and political interdependencies between the participating countries are relatively weak. And from the perspective of the EU member states, the danger of negative spillovers caused by market integration are low if compared to would-be EU member states. And therefore, we see that market integration in this kind of integration regime that we call shallow integration or shallow mode of integration is first based on gradual tariff liberalization and selective regulatory integration that leaves poorer countries more leeway for preparing their economies for market opening and insertion in transnational value chain, but often ignores that these countries are actually not necessarily capable to use these opportunities wisely. And under this mode of integration, this is also very important, the EU provides relatively scarce assistance for building developmental state capacities. And this is not only, you know, the mode the EU applies towards these neighboring countries, but is also the default strategy of most integration regimes around the world, from NAFTA to Mercosur. That said, we also have to note that the EU has started to change its approach towards the three associated Eastern Partnership countries, at least Ukraine, Moldova, and Georgia, from 2014 onwards, because in the context of the association agreement that includes a deep and free comprehensive free trade area, the EU offers full trade liberalization, except for in very sensitive sectors like some agri-food sectors, comprehensive regulatory integration, but only limited assistance if compared to the Eastern enlargement, for example, of the Central and Eastern European countries. There is slightly more assistance provided for Ukraine, but interestingly, it's only focusing on building what we call core state capacities, such as an independent judiciary or a competition authority. And it leaves the other two developmental state capacity aside that are needed to integrate peripheral economies successfully in transnational markets. Vera, you have done quite some research on the integration of the southern EU member states, and I think the approach I just described resembles the integration strategy the EU applied towards the south in the beginning. Is this correct?
Yes, definitely. So the southern periphery starts off from this weak form of integration that you just described. But the difference is that the liberalization at the time is also asymmetric. So the EU offers full access to its market, while its partners remain free to pursue the old-fashioned industrial policy. So in that sense, it leaves more space for the state to accommodate. And this is something that should not be forgotten, because for the new peripheries, the countries without the prospect of accession, the risk of integration is greater because they don't have access to these tools anymore. Now, of course, it doesn't mean that pursuing old-fashioned industrial policy is always a recipe for success. We know that it has often led to big flops. But also, it doesn't mean that these countries preferred it, because in many ways it was a shallow level of commitment from the EU, so it was reversible. Whenever the core would feel threatened, they could easily cut off this form of liberalization. So for the South, the shift from that to the deep integration is obviously beneficial, because it offers the big incentive of membership, but the shift is also very, very rapid. So it goes from this very gradual a la carte shallow integration to full regulatory integration, complete trade liberalization, and all of this happens relatively quickly compared to the later accession process in Central and Eastern Europe. Under those conditions, the two problems of capacity of domestic state and non-state actors that Laszlo was talking about before, of living by the rules of market integration, were supposed to be overcome by simply providing the right incentives. So the opportunities offered by the market access to this big, rich, wealthy European market, the threats that if we are not competitive, you don't brush up, you don't equip your own firms with the capabilities, they will not survive on their own market, which is now shared. The threat of punishment by the EU's ever more stringent competition policy, if you run afoul of these rules, all of these were supposed to galvanize the state and the private actors into action to set up the right institutions, the support structures, to attract investment, to help the local firms plug into the transnational division of labor in the right way, and to benefit from integration. Now, of course, if you look at the political discussions around this time, nobody in the southern periphery thought that this was how it happens. Nobody thought that this kind of adjustment was going to be automatic. So the reason that we have the cohesion funds today was that Spain insisted and conditioned its acceptance of the Maastricht Treaty on extra support for these lagging members. So it was clear to them that they needed more than just the rules. But, you know, in the context in which we were talking about before of support for the core administrative state structures, what happened in the south was relatively quick, deep integration and some form of correction, of market correction through the structural funds, but not really much investment into the core state capacities.
Mm-hmm. And Laszlo, to what extent did the EU actually continue this approach in the context of the Eastern enlargement of the Central and Eastern European economies?
The strategy of the EU during the Eastern enlargement was dramatically different from the one applied in the South, what was described by Vera. It was in the early 90s when the Washington Consensus dominated thinking about markets, and it was taken as granted that the markets will be able to integrate these countries, but not in Brussels. In Brussels, there was a very strong fear, primarily by the old member states, and first of all Germany, that these countries will neither be able to play by the rules, they don't have the right administrative and legal state capacities, nor will they be able to benefit from these rules, and they might actually collapse like a house of cards when exposed to competition with the strongest economies on the globe. So the fear was that if the EU will leave solely to market and market incentives to the integration of these countries, like it did in the South, then that might endanger the market integration and might impose extreme costs on the old member states. So they worked out a very interesting strategy that tried to address these fears and these problems. So they invested a lot in the administrative capacities of these states, not just the Copenhagen criteria, but also the more explicit requirements for membership or conditionality included important elements about elementary judiciary autonomy and capacity, and also about the capacities and the independence of the civil service. But way beyond that, the EU and the Commission invested a lot in creating what one can call as the first elements of transnational economic policy and transnational industrial policy. It means that it did not believe that these countries will be capable of learning in time and managing time the largest negative developmental consequences of being exposed to competition in this the enlarged market. So they invaded these countries with thousands of experts and demanded them to create developmental plans, sector by sector and policy area by policy area, telling what will be the consequences of implementing the EU rules and how these countries would like to, so to say, remedy the potential large-scale negative consequences. So it, concrete policies might have differed country by country or sector by sector, but the EU employed, first time in its history, a supranational network, institutional apparatus, to detect in time and also manage in time these possible consequences of market integration. And also it invested a lot in building elementary state capacities in these countries to foresee not just what might be the large-scale negative consequences of integration and exposing their firms and economic actors to regional level competition, but also the first institutions were introduced by the EU and the first elementary state capacities to improve the competitive position of these firms, how the state could manage that. So that's these are the two things. And finally, just I would like to add to that, that the big problem is that after these countries joined the EU, after 2004, all these policies were discontinued. So both the criteria and the control and continuous monitoring of state capacities and autonomy and the judicial capacity of autonomy were discontinued, and also these supranational economic policy and industrial policy, all these institutional elements, or most of these institutional elements, were forgotten and not used neither in the East after 2008 nor in the South.
Laszlo, I think we will get back to the weakness of the EU post-accession approach a bit later, but let me pick up on what you just said, that the EU did invest so tremendously in building up developmental state capacity in the pre-accession period during Eastern enlargement. But then I think your research, Vera, shows that by looking at Poland and Romania, your research shows quite clearly that some countries actually made better use of the opportunities offered by the EU in the context of the Eastern enlargement than others. So how do you explain this variation?
Right. So the thing that we talked about until now was the difference between different strategies. But of course, even within the groups of countries to which the same strategy applied, we see quite a lot of variation. And well, frankly, in the context of industrial development, asking why some countries do better than others is the kind of most straightforward answer, is that because it is really not easy to succeed. So as Laszlo was saying, we're really talking about differences within a rather constrained opportunity set, which is delimited by the paramount objective of market integration and market efficiency, competitiveness. So industrial upgrading in the peripheral regions of a highly integrated European market doesn't mean building new industries, new industrial champions. It means largely fitting into the transnational value chains of the existing ones. So, which is not to say that building champions is any easier. History is peppered with counterexamples. But nurturing a successful layer of small and medium enterprises that can plug into these opportunities in the larger markets is really hard work. So, you know, throughout Europe, everybody pays lip service to small and medium enterprises, but we know that there are very few member states that do it really well. And what it requires is a network of well-embedded institutional structures to support these firms, not only at the top, but also at the local and regional levels. And it isn't even only about providing these firms with financing. It's about finding ways of training the workers, linking companies together, providing support for marketing, internationalization, other entrepreneurial skills. So the EU offers funding for it. But its funding is also tricky. You have to spend it efficiently. You have to distribute the funds to promising projects. And so you have to make sure that companies submit good enough projects, and you need to have the capacity to follow up on them. So in this special issue, we have a paper with Gergő Medve-Balint, a colleague from the Political Science Institute in Budapest, where we compare Poland and Romania, as you said, and their support for the automotive industry firms. And we show that it makes a huge difference that in many parts of Poland, there is this thick network of local and regional institutions that links up with the big governmental and EU programs and then helps the local companies to access the funds. Whereas in Romania, there are also big developmental programs at the top, but there are no local support structures, except in one or two regions in the western parts of Romania. And so the funding cannot even get to the firms, and the rate of utilization of the funding will be low. So far fewer smaller and medium enterprises in this industry in Romania receive support than in Poland. Now, we know this, right? We always talk about the problem with the absorption of funding in some of these countries. And if you have an absorption problem, there are really two ways to solve it. You can build up local institutions, but that's a long-term project, or you can centralize the funding and try to give as much of it as you can to big firms that can always pay a consultancy to write a project. And that's efficient, but then you get these dual economies in which a small internationalized segment of firms pulls ahead and then the rest falls behind. And so in this way, the weakness of local administrative capacities directly translates into a failure to provide resources for growth for the companies that need them the most. So this is the structural, the institutional aspect for it. But of course, there are also political dimensions to it, which I think the two of you are even better placed to explain.
Let me just briefly add to that, that the institutions differ dramatically what Vera said. So they, with Gergő, describe differences across new member states. But this is what we find, that the institutions, if you look at a longer term perspective, these institutional differences, differences in the organization of different economic players, differences in endowments of states, in support organizations, whatever, they are due also to, and primarily due to differences in developmental coalitions. That is how and to what extent are the dominating state and economic elites pursuing more or less inclusive policies. So just an example, the illiberal regimes of Poland and Hungary are very different from this perspective, which means that they build very different institutions. In Hungary, you have one of the most exclusionary developmental coalitions that tries to support domestic business, sometimes at the price of multinationals and primarily also the middle and lower middle class, whereas the Polish regime supports productive ties between domestic economic actors and transnational firms. It is much more inclusionary in social and economic policies, starting from education to healthcare. So these are differences in developmental coalitions that shape then institutional developments in very different directions.
Yes, and an additional important factor that has an effect on how countries make use of the opportunities of this integration strategy refers to the particular political ideology regarding the developmental role of states. Our colleague Vishnia Vukov showed in her research on Romania that the neoliberal ideology guiding Romania's economic policies yielded development led by multinational companies. So this means that promoting development in Romania is primarily about supporting multinational corporations rather than strengthening local businesses. And this is why we can observe the evolution of exclusionary developmental alliances, Laszlo was just talking about, that largely exclude a broader base of economic actors, including small and medium enterprises. And, you know, interestingly, our colleague Olga Miakiewicz found for Poland that accounts that portray Poland as a champion of neoliberal reforms after 1990 are wrong. And in her study on the development of Poland's automotive industry, Olga finds that the Polish state has used various industrial policies since the early 1990s to insert and position the automotive sector in European markets. So the Polish state applied protectionist measures to prepare the local automotive industry for market opening, paving the way for a high share of foreign ownership. But it also used EU regulations to strictly monitor foreign investors, and this prevented foreign investors from exploiting EU funds without upgrading the local automotive sector. And again, in contrast to the neoliberal Romanian state, the Polish state developed industrial policies that prevented the automotive sector from turning into a mere assembly platform for MNCs. So instead, it has pursued policies for developing a suppliers network with diversified forward linkages and thereby decreasing the dependence on lead MNCs. But still, you know, despite these kind of rather positive developmental outcomes, we witness a large, you know, discontent with the way the EU manages market integration in nearly all countries. I mean, Poland, Hungary, Italy, Spain, Greece. So to what extent can this trend be related to the weakness of the EU post-accession approach? Laszlo, you were referring to it earlier already during our discussion.
Yeah, basically the most important problem is that the EU didn't learn much from the experience of the Eastern enlargement. So those active economic and industrial policies that the EU pursued were discontinued and treats the developmental consequences of market integration as a domestic level problem. Whereas in the pre-accession period, it acknowledged that that might be a systemic problem. It tries to push, download all the responsibilities to the level of member states while extending the disciplinary measures of the union. So it's a very one-sided integration strategy that limits and in a way even straitjackets the room for developmental policies in the member states. On the other hand, washes its hands if these countries fail. So that's the basic problem. The other problem is more specific to some of these countries is that the EU discontinued also the control of the quality of the state. It means that, for example, in the regimes like Hungary, incumbents can use structural funds and the weakness of the autonomy of judiciary and civil service to build up patron-client networks and strengthen the political basis and not for the development. So these are the basic problems.
So if I might just add a little to what Laszlo was saying, it is not only that the EU has disregarded the lessons of the Eastern enlargement and basically delegated the resolution of these consequences of uneven integration to the member states. It's also that, especially in the context of the resolution of the Eurozone crisis, it has forced a certain type of solutions onto these countries. So I have done quite a lot of research on Spain and the way that Spain has managed this industrial policy in the course of integration. And it was heartbreaking to watch how the austerity measures essentially undermined all the hard work that's been put in to keep up these institutions of industrial success. And this was a Herculean effort because the industrial successes of Spain took place alongside the enormous inflationary pressures that came from all the hot money that was flowing into the real estate bubble, whereas they had to keep up with the cheaper locations in East Central Europe, with the massive increase in productivity in Germany, partly due to the outsourcing to East and Central Europe. And suddenly none of that was worth anything anymore, and you had to cut all these support structures, and Spain was basically implicitly told to follow the success story of East Central Europe. Whereas the lean and mean success story of East Central Europe, that narrative neglects the fundamental dualization of these economies and the resentment that in response to that has been building up, which is something that these populist parties have been able to tap into.
Well, maybe a final question. What could be the more general lessons from the effects of EU strategies for market integration attempts in other parts of the world? I think, you know, from our special issue, the key lesson is that the extension of market integration requires political institutions that can manage the negative consequences of liberal markets plus complex market correcting mechanisms. But the problem, I think, is that there has been no appetite so far for more integration among the majority of EU member states. So we see the rise of right-wing populists who are likely to exploit moves towards more integration. So populists from core countries like Germany, but also the Netherlands or Austria, will denounce any attempt to introduce more complex market correcting policies as a tool that, in their view, subsidizes inefficient and often corrupt governments in the East and South. And in turn, populists from the Eastern or Southern peripheries criticize the strong dependencies from foreign investors or the yoke of the EU's monetary rules and turn to economic nationalism. And what is more, and Laszlo has already pointed to that before, is that Central and Eastern European member states are unlikely to support the evolution of stronger political institutions that could force them to stick to the rule of law and spend EU funds in a way that supports inclusive development, while at the same time, the same political forces from Central and Eastern Europe abuse the lack of more supranational powers for getting stronger. And Lazo, you already talked about it, that they use structural funds to build up patron client networks rather than investing them in inclusive developmental alliances. So what are your thoughts on this question? What are the more general lessons from the effects of EU strategies for integration attempts in other parts of the world?
The only small thing I would really like to add to this Julia's point, which is excellent, that indeed market integration does need institutions to manage its negative consequences. That's just the nature of capitalism, right? It tends towards inequality. And if we want to have a cohesive community, there has to be a way to correct for it. So what Julia has described, this deadlock between the populists, is a direct consequence of the renationalization of the European politics that has happened in the fat years in the 2000s. This is when we have let slip the original promise of multi-level governance, of the Europe of regions, of Europe of citizens, that has tried to invest in precisely these kinds of local and regional structures that would then, through their connection to the supranational level, be empowered to also challenge their own national governments. Instead, we have allowed for centralization of the European structural funds, of the developmental capacities, that makes it much easier for those to be hijacked by the extremists.
Mm-hmm. I would add to that, if I may, that the most important lesson of the last 10-15 years of integration, first of all, the crisis of the EU, is that market integration is a highly political issue and it cannot be depoliticized. Any attempt of depolitization will strike back. The other lesson is that how market integration is politicized, how the member states and the different units in integration are represented, makes difference. And that reminds me of the debate between Hamilton and Madison. During the COVID crisis, lots of journalists were talking about the arrival of Hamilton's moment. Hamilton was the first minister of finances, I would say, of the US, and he introduced the mutualization of the debt, basically centralization of the debts of the states. And the idea behind that of Hamilton was that by mutualizing that, also it can create, the federal state can create bonds among the different states, economic actors, create economic incentives to care about the common good of the integrated market. Now, Madison was very skeptical about that because he thought that these are very fleeting bonds, and the mutualization of debts. And he was thinking that there is a need for political mutualization, so to say, mechanisms that allow for the different member states not only to represent their specific national interests, but also represents the common interests. And this is missing. So the EU as a polity is preventing the solution of this crisis and management, the longer-term management of these problems, because it institutionalizes basically parochialism, national-level parochialism. The core countries, and this is what we can see in the last 10 years, they have politicians there are accountable only to their own citizens, of the countries of their own citizens, and not to the citizens of the South or the East or of any other countries. And so they have very strong incentives to externalize as much as possible the costs of the regional free market, basically to have the free market for free, and at the same time discipline as much as possible the southerners and easterners who are diverse from that. So it's whereas the Madisonian strategy of federal polity that gives representation not only to the states but also to the people of the United States allows for unity and diversity. This regime that we have now, this is built primarily on exclusive accountability at national level. It cannot sustain this kind of neither the diversity nor the unity, and it's basically misses the key element that would allow to create these bonds that Hamilton was hoping in with financial solutions. It's missing basically the representation of Europeans.
Well, I think these are the perfect last words for this podcast. Thank you so much, Laszlo and Vera, for participating in this discussion, and take good care.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks.